In Australia, there's been a lot of discussion about racism recently, particularly in the last few weeks as the federal government moves to alter Australia's race discrimination laws, perhaps making it okay to offend, insult, humiliate or intimidate. And of course, the Attorney General John Brandis's remark in the Senate that people do have a right to be bigots will certainly be a major issue in this debate. But what exactly is racism, putting aside bigotry itself? With all the debates and legislation aimed at curbing it, is actually racism a natural part of the human condition? In fact, has it anything to do with race at all? Francisco Betancourt is the Charles Boxer Professor of History at King's College London, and he's written a fairly comprehensive book called Racisms, From the Crusades to the 20th Century, where he argues that racism is not, in fact, an innate part of being human. It's a political phenomenon. Francisco joins me from Cambridge. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Well, thank you. My definition of racism is that it concerns prejudices on ethnic descent coupled with discriminatory action.
So this separation of prejudice from discrimination in your definition is interesting. Why? I mean, surely if you're prejudiced, you discriminate.
No, you can have prejudices without action. People can have bad opinion on people on specific ethnic groups. People can have their prejudices, but they don't engage in collective action. And that is the main issue concerning racism. You need prejudices coupled with discriminatory action. And racism is a collective phenomenon. Of course, you can have individual prejudices, which contribute, obviously, to the collective phenomenon, but you have to look at it from a collective point of view and from the point of view of collective action. So you need both sides of the equation. You need prejudice concerning ethnic descent, and you need discriminatory action. That's what defines racism. You can make inquiries on people, and they can express their prejudices, but if they don't move collectively, you don't have a racist situation.
So an individual act of discrimination doesn't cut it. You know, calling somebody racist who's got prejudice and discriminates personally by not allowing somebody in their restaurant or throwing them at the back of the bus, that is
action.
That is action, but it's not collective
action. Clearly. That person acted in a racist way. So he discriminated persons. It's not only a matter of opinion. So we discriminated. So that configurates a case of racism. The problem you raised at the very beginning was, is it a human condition to be racist? And my research doesn't show it at all. It's not innate. And my research does not prove that. My research shows that there are specific historical conditions that favor the emergence of racism.
Just give me that sense of historical validity to that statement, given that what seems at first sight to be prejudiced against the other is so pervasive throughout history. And it spans, while your book seems to focus on Europe, although you do cover Asia, you do get prejudiced against other in other communities. I mean, I've just spent a week in Japan where there's a major controversy yet again about Koreans in Japan. And, you know, a Korean guide in a Japanese shrine has created an outcry. It does seem to span cultures.
Well, not in every culture. And also this situation between Japan and Korea has historical roots, because first you had the Far East is an area of constant exchange of religion and culture. And this conflict between Japan and Korea comes from the end of the 16th century when Japan tried to invade Korea and it was defeated. But they brought with them a significant number of several thousands of Koreans enslaved. And then again, by the turn of the 19th to the 20th century again, Japan invaded Korea. So there are specific historical contexts that justify this racism.
Which is why you argue that it's about politics, not about race.
It is, well, basically, in many cases. Here we have several interpretations. You have the Marxist interpretation concerning the division of labor and how social hierarchies are justified through theories of races, and racism undermines people and allows these hierarchies to get more rooted. I do not follow this interpretation because in some cases it's visible concerning relations with African Americans, concerning the situations in South Africa, for instance. You have, this can contribute to understand better the phenomenon, but we cannot generalize this Marxist interpretation because in many cases what you have is competition for resources. So it's not only a justification of hierarchies, but racism is triggered by competition for resources. For instance, in Iberia, which is one of the earlier cases of racism, of ethnic racism, you have a conflict between Christians and Muslims around and Jews around resources, and they were not placed at the bottom of a social hierarchy. So Muslims and Jews were competing for the same resources, for the centers of cities, for control of property, urban and rural property.
But wasn't that about... I mean, this is where you get this conflation. You're talking about politics. You're talking, let's take Spain and Portugal, your example of Iberia, which was classically a story of religion, was it not? I mean, you're getting caught up in the Crusades here, the ebbing and flowing of very violent activity between Muslims and Christians, primarily with Jews caught in the crossfire, which was about territory and purity of religion rather than resources. And in amongst all that were ethnicities as well.
But it boils down to resources, because the big competition was who controlled political power, who controlled access to land, who controlled the main central neighborhoods and cities. And that's why you have policies of exclusion. Religion was at the background, but these Muslim populations received these prejudices of ethnic descent. So religion was coupled with this idea that they would have mental and physical attributes inherited from generation to generation. And so you had the religious background coupled with these prejudices concerning ethnic descent. And the proof is that when they were forced to convert, both Muslim people and Jewish people, these prejudices stayed exactly the same. There's a continuity, which is unique in history, because generally universal ideas of Christianity as a message sent to save all humankind, for the first time, these people were not sufficiently integrated.
So they had new Christians and old Christians, and the new Christians... So
exactly, there was a division between new Christians and old Christians, and through an ethnic divide. They were converted, but they were discriminated afterwards. So it was it's a typical case of racism.
Well, yes, indeed. But I'm getting confused, because if you say the basis was religion and they converted and they were still prejudiced against because they looked different, they had a bloodline that might be considered different, isn't that getting to the core of racism rather than resources and politics? Because you've eliminated the politics, and what you're left with is a core of racism.
No, it's exactly the opposite. It shows, I think, this case of conversion and this followed by discrimination shows that what was at stake was competition for resources. Because
the old Christians felt threatened resource-wise.
Because these converted Muslims and Jews, they still controlled urban neighborhoods and urban property. In the case of Muslims, they controlled vast land and also certain arts and crafts. So it was competition between these groups of old Christians and these new Christians for resources. So this is what triggered racism. That's why I think that prejudices by themselves, if there is not at stake competition, they don't trigger discriminatory action. And the proof is that, for instance, when I compared the case of Jewish people in Germany and Jewish people in Spain and Portugal in the 20th century, in the first half of the 20th century, in Spain and Portugal, they had become extreme minority, a tiny minority, because they had come back from North Africa in the mid-19th century.
Because they'd been expelled in the 15th century.
Yes, they had been expelled by the end of the 15th century. And so they came back in the 19th century, but they were a tiny minority. So they were not discriminated, because they were not in a position to be targeted as competitors.
Don't you still have to define the dominant group, and that starts getting you back to a concept of race, which is fundamental? So in other words, in the 19th century, with the growth of European nationalism, you had a lot of Jews converting to Christianity, and yet there was still, in the 20th century, there was still an open door, if you like, for Hitler's redefinition of race and some sort of dominant group.
Well, in the case of Germany and Hitler, there were two phenomena playing there. First, there had been a certain tradition in the 19th century of anti-Judaism in Germany, and the main economic crisis had triggered upheavals against Jewish communities accused of mishandling financial resources. So there was a competition there, and there were these prejudices concerning ethnic descent playing there heavily. And in the case of the second factor was, in the case of Hitler, he saw the possibility of political mobilization created by this anti-Jewish stance. So he basically targeted the Jewish people, and he considered left-wing people as pro-Jewish. So it was through these ethnic prejudices that he managed to monopolize power.
So how do you explain white prejudice against blacks, particularly through slavery and the embedded notion for centuries that Africans were inferior, which you will still find in some groups in North America?
Yeah. Well, the case of prejudice concerning skin color, it has to do with slavery and with slave trade, which was a major in the throughout fifth century, from the 6th to the mid-19th century. You had 12.5 million Africans forced to move to America. And so you had this extraordinary hierarchy with a significant number of Africans at the bottom of the scale. And racism, of course, kicked in to justify it. It's one of the cases in which you have the Marxist interpretation.
So this is about economic power and not wanting to relinquish it.
Yeah, it's the justification of economic and social power.
And you also link behavior to racism, too. It's not just skin color or physical appearance, but behaviors have been assigned as well.
Yes. That's why I think historical context is crucial, because what happened in the Americas is totally different from what happened in Europe or in Japan or in India. In India, we can talk about an internal racism through the caste system, because they have 15% of the population, even nowadays, are outcast. So you have entirely different configurations of racism in different parts of the world. And
well, you do and you don't. I mean, if you take the Indian situation and also take even within African Americans in the United States, they will discriminate against skin color as well. So the blacker you are in India, the blacker you are in the United States, there are within ethnic group prejudices as well. How do you explain those?
Yeah, you are right. You are right. There is in India the same pattern of rejection or prejudice concerning darker skin. So there is no evidence that this is innate. It has to do with historical conditions, how conflict for land proceeded in different parts of the world.
I can't finish this interview without a remarkable illustration or graphic in your book is the appearance of a black saint, an African saint, in the 13th century by the name of Maurice. It's extraordinary.
This is one of the interesting things in history, because history is never linear, is never a continuous line accumulating either prejudices or good intentions. So you have all the irregular ups and downs or different visions coming in. And the case of the Black Saint is one of the cases, because it is linked to this legend of a saint from an Egyptian battalion of the Roman Empire. And he was then later considered to be black. but it was not at the beginning. So you have different visions of St. Moritz as white and black, and it became black in certain regions of Germany. And blackness could be related to the three wise men, because one of the three wise men became more and more linked to Africa due to this idea of universal message of the Christian Church.
So what you're saying here is that when there wasn't a threat, a perceived political threat, people were quite happy to accept a black saint without the prejudice attached. So just before we go, Francisco Betancourt, what do we do with this information? If we accept your theory that, in fact, racism is not a part of the human condition, but it is political, and within its historical context, which is why you call it racisms, what do we do with this?
Well, we can be alert against conflict around resources, because, for instance, in South Sudan nowadays, what we have then in the newest country in the world, what you have there is a conflict between Dinka and Nuer for oil, because they inherited three quarters of the oil richness of Sudan, and they lost their traditional ways of exploring land and cattle, because through civil war the land was devastated and cattle massively disappeared. And now they are used to war, and they are competing for control of these extraordinary resources of oil. So these historical experiences can alert us for what can happen if people are reduced to capacity for war, and they only have one big asset there. And so we can from an international point of view, you can help these people, you can try to intervene, and help them to avoid this conflict for resources, because this is the main trigger for racism.
Francis Betancourt, look, thank you for joining us here on Saturday Extra. We could have spent a lot of time talking about indigenous communities in places like Australia and the reason for them, but I think it starts to become apparent. And so thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for calling.
Francisco Betancourt, I should say, is the Charles Boxer Professor of History at King's College London, and his book is called Racisms, From the Crusades to the 20th Century, and it's published by Princeton University Press. Coming up here on Saturday Extra with me, Norman Swan, all that glitters in the world of yellow diamonds.